Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, good afternoon.
Thank you all for coming. This is the list up on the board of the four presentations that I've been involved in. The first one was about the world views and personal regional views of health and healthcare. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about religion and spirituality and the interaction of those with health, and talked a little bit about intercessory prayer. This afternoon, we're going to talk about successful aging, aging in general, and then successful aging, and just going to throw out a bunch of stuff and see where that leads us. And this evening at 8:15, we're going to talk about an introduction to medical ethics, how professionals in the medical world deal with ethical dilemmas and quandaries, and how we are dealing and how each of us will deal in our own way with end-of-life issues, because that's something that none of us will not deal with, and most of us here have dealt with respect to friends, family members, and we have a lot more control over the end of life than we think we do. All right, successful aging. Somebody said this earlier, it's something that I agree with completely. Regrets in old age are for things not done. And that may say something about successful aging. Probably successful aging is the end result of successful living. Okay, who wants to live to be 100? All the young people. You guys will find out what it's like.
Why not 110?
Why not? Or 150 or 200. And it may be possible. It may be possible. Probably not in some of our generation, but it may very well be possible in the generations that are following us. All right, what are we going to do today? We're going to talk a little bit about definitions and philosophical questions, explain something about life expectancies and theories of aging. Age is a risk factor for disease. A few words about how we die. Some of the determinants of health we've talked about, and I won't spend a lot of time on that. We'll talk about lifestyle and habits that promote longevity, and advice from the grave or from the graveside, from people who have preceded us. Not that they preceded us in death, but they've gotten close and we've been able to look at them and see what made their life successful or not successful, as the case may be. All right, philosophical questions. Is there a maximum age limit for humans? Up until now, there has been. And right now, there still is. But that may change. And that may change in some of our generations, and certainly it may very well change in the next 50 years, and that's going to have a profound effect on the planet and a profound effect on how we deal with just about everything. And as a corollary of that, should we attempt to extend the maximum lifespan, or is that really an area that we really should not be getting into? Another philosophical question is, ageless youth preferable to the seasons of life? For those of us in the later seasons, we're all going to say, well, seasons of life have been great, but I guess if we really answered that honestly, maybe we would choose ageless youth. Should age be a factor in the rationing of healthcare services? I mean, that's really an important question that most of us with gray hair would say, well, of course not. And what are the benefits and disadvantages of segregating the elderly into retirement villages? And I think most of us have some opinions about that. I'm not going to try to define aging. I think it will become, as we go along through the discussion this afternoon, I think we'll all kind of come out with a sense about what aging is and what successful aging is. But I will talk a little bit about aging in the 19th century. Somebody asked me yesterday about the clergy do better than the general population or whatever in terms of survival. And I don't have any recent data, but I do have data from the between 1843 and 1866, if that's of any interest to you. And what it said at that time, that the average age of death of lawyers in the state of Massachusetts, this is between 1843 and 1866, was 56 years. Of judges, 66 years. Of physicians, 55 years. and of clergymen, 58 years. So clergy live just a little longer than doctors. The judges live the longest. Now, does any scientist out there or a statistician immediately know, in order to become a judge, you probably have to start off being old. You know, you didn't pick a judge at infancy or something like that. So you know, and it's the same thing for to a much lesser extent, the physicians and lawyers. But judges were lawyers who had lived for a while, and so they naturally would look like they're older. It isn't that offered any, I don't think offered any particular longevity advantage. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, dated May 2nd, 1896, some advice was given to physicians. So this was advice about aging for physicians, and I thought you might find this interesting. I certainly did. It said, the lesson, then, we should learn from our deceased colleagues is not to work too long. When you find your arterial tension increasing, your temporal artery becoming tortuous, your radial growing hard, especially if you have had a little palpitation and pass an increased amount of limpid urine, whatever your years, know that old age is upon you. Henceforth, shape your life like one that is old. Curb your ambition. Be content with a small practice. Reduce your expenses. Give up your night work. Decline confinements. Take a long vacation in summer. Retire early. Drink not at all. Sell your horse. Take a great deal of moderate exercise in the open air. Watch the functions of the skin. Guard against the chill. Cultivate an even disposition. Study to be quiet. So when you know old age is upon you, it's the advice given to physicians in the Journal of the American Medical Association a little over 100 years ago was to act your age. All right. That question's still out there. I don't think we've answered it yet. Let's look at some of the oldest people in the world. Of the 10 confirmed oldest persons, all were women. Which we know that's why that is. If you women have a much easier life than men, don't have anything to worry about. The oldest was Jean Calment, who lived in France. She lived to be 122 years old. Now, there's articles that you may come across the internet of somebody in the Andes or something that's 140. Though none of those have been confirmed with actual birth certificates or any hard evidence of when they were born. So it's not known whether that's absolute, but certainly no one in the Western world that has where we have documentation has lived longer than 122 years. The oldest American was Sarah Knaus, who died at the age of 119. The 10 oldest were all 115 and older. They were all women. So what can we learn from Jean Calment, the world's oldest person? She died in 1977, 122 years. She rode a bicycle until age 100. She lived independently in an apartment to 110. And don't let me leave this slide without telling you something about the apartment. She consumed olive oil and everything. 2 pounds of chocolate per week, and she drank port wine every day. She quit smoking at age
27. Let's get back to it.
She was described as being absolutely unflappable. Her attitude was, if you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it. At the age of 80, her lawyer made a deal with her. And her lawyer was about 50. And she had a really nice apartment in a small town in southern France. And the lawyer said, I would like to have your apartment when you die. And she said, well, that would be okay, and I'll sign it over to you, but I should be allowed to live in it until I die. And he said, oh, that's no problem. She's already in her 80s. And she said, I'd like you to pay me a little bit just so I have some living expenses. And he said, oh, you know, a couple thousand francs a month would be just fine. I'll pay that to you. A decade went by, and he kept writing checks, and she kept living in the apartment. Another decade went by, and then another decade went by. He died. His heirs continued to write checks to her to the tune of well over 100 or 200,000 francs over and above what the value of the apartment was. She was quite a lady. All right. The downside of that, her last 4 or 5 years of life were not all that great. She was essentially blind. She was almost completely deaf. She had rather severe arthritis. So it wasn't that, I mean, she had quality of life for a long time. She never required any surgery. The other thing that she did, she married a very rich man when she was young. And so she didn't have a lot of worries and concerns through much of her life. Okay, life expectancy is the average age at which the entire population will have died. So when we talk about life expectancy at birth, all the people born at a certain time, like this year, they can expect that when we average it all out at the end, that if it's 80 years, that's what the average age is. A few people are going to live longer, and a number of people are going to live shorter than that. The lifespan is what they refer to kind of as the warranty life. If you buy something, it's the warranty of your automobile or whatever is what the age that most individuals can expect to live in a given environment. And right now, it's roughly 75 years. And then there's something called essential lifespan, which is the Darwinian purpose of life, which is to reproduce and to keep the population going. For fruit flies, it's a week. For humans, about 50 years. Any questions about that? You look puzzled? No. I'd like to make a couple of distinctions between living well and living long, because that's all going to get mixed up in my presentation, because a lot of things we're going to talk about are things that are associated with longevity, and that doesn't necessarily mean that's a high quality of life. Our first session here, we really talked a lot about health and health care, and those things are not the same. And that the purpose of health care is to promote health, but health in itself may not be a goal versus having a meaningful life. And if you don't have good health, then it's going to be much harder to achieve a very full and satisfying or meaningful life. Whereas if you do have good health throughout your entire life, then it's going to be easier for you to achieve that. Well, that's pretty obvious. That's sort of talking like a geologist. All right, I've got a couple graphs over here. And I don't know how well you can see them. Up at the top, this is a survival curve. So what we're looking at is the percent survival of the population, from 100% down to zero, and we got age. And we have different curves for different periods of time in the world. So the lowest curve down here is Africa, 50,000 years ago. Europe, that's the first humans kind of climbing out of trees and walking around on the planet. Europe, 15,000 years ago, at the time of Cro-Magnon man and the Neanderthals. Rome at 100 BC, and USA today. So what we see is these earlier curves, a tremendous drop-off early in life. High childhood mortality, high infant mortality, high infectious diseases in the young kids. Then we see that this curve then progressively dropped off over time. Much of this was traumatic deaths. People were living out there with tigers and lions and whatever else. But people still live back in, even in the 50,000 BC, there were still 70-year-old and 80-year-old people walking around. Not very many. And it was just very few. Most of the people would have died by their life expectancy back then. If you then averaged all these deaths, it's really skewed. Life expectancy was less than 20 years. But it didn't mean that everybody was dead at 20 years. That a clear concept?
Yes.
Okay, so Europe, you see the curve is changing. We're still having drop-off early among child mortality, but we're seeing that more people are surviving and living longer, even in Rome. And by the time we get to now, there isn't much of a drop-off in that first year to me. It's less than 1% of kids are dying in that first year of life in the United States. We're living longer, and then we're kind of dropping off here as we get older. I have a curve here that I say ideal. Can we live all the way out here to close to our 100-year-old expectancy and then just all die kind of quickly out here? Or are we going to continue to have this kind of a curve? Any questions about that top curve? The middle curve is the mortality rate versus age. So this is
How many people are dying when they're infants, when they're between the ages of 15 and 45 or 50, and how many die per? This like would be a, this would be a rate per 1,000 or per 10,000, something like that. And you see it's relatively high early on, drops, and then starts to rise. This is a remarkable curve when you think about that, because we don't see just a continuous steady drop-off of the human population, but we see infants dropping off, young people dropping off, and then in the reproductive years, there's hardly any mortality at all.
Is that worldwide?
That's worldwide. But the curves will be shifted in different cultures, and in sub-Saharan Africa, there's going to be much higher infant, so this could be much higher right here. And unfortunately, right now in sub-Saharan Africa, this curve through here is going to be considerably higher because of the age epidemic. Eliminated age, you would see. And this doesn't surprise us. I mean, we think of 20, 30-year-old people as being the really strong members of our society and of our species. And those are the reproductive years. And so that's obviously that we have evolved to have that kind of wellness during that period of time. The bottom curve, any questions about that? The bottom curve is looking at functional capacity, and this now we're getting, this is just looking at survival versus now we're interested in what most of it are interested in is the functional capacity. 100%, which means that we are capable of doing everything that a strong, healthy person would be capable of doing, and obviously when you get down less than 50%, you're going to be pretty much dependent on other people. When you get down to 20%, you're kind of bedridden. So that's what we're looking at in terms of functional capacity. And we see right now that we have this curve, and that people are dropping off here. By the time you get to be 100, there are very few people that are good functional capacity. The question is, as more people live longer, where is this curve going to go? It's been moving in this direction. And we call this area, the people that have dropped, that have lost functional capacity, this would be ideal. They remain very functional until they die. That's what we would all like to have happen to us. This area is morbidity, and we talk about, well, the statisticians talk about compression of morbidity. That's what we would like to do, is to bring this curve over time, 2011 here, in 1950 it was down here somewhere, we're moving it in that direction. We would like to get it out here so that people are functionally, they maintain their functional capacity right to the end of life. It doesn't do a whole lot of good if we move the survival curve out, but all these people that survive are in nursing homes or bedridden or dependent on other people who they care. So this really, to a large extent, is what we're talking about when we're talking about successful aging or living well or aging well. So we want to compress that morbidity. Morbidity just means illness or disease or disability. Yes, sir?
Increasing that last curve may create more unemployment.
That certainly is possible if we don't have productive things for people to do. You're absolutely right. That's another issue for the economists and to deal with, as opposed to what we're trying. It'd be nice to have those people. Another way of looking at it, we have more people who can engage in the activities that they want to engage in for a longer period of time in their life. So with, coming to Holden Village, reading books, doing whatever useful activity. Okay, well, let's just look at life expectancy. You've seen this. Some of you were here on Monday, saw this curve, which is just the life expectancy. Right now, this is where we are. The United States is down here with 38th in the world, and we don't rank too highly. Within, by states, I made sure that Washington, Oregon, Minnesota is right up there for you Lutherans who come from Minnesota. You live long and you live well. Utah is probably high because of the they don't drink or smoke as anywhere near as high numbers as we see in some of the other states. Hawaii is just a great place to live, I think. So is Holden Village.
All right, how we die. I guess you can't talk about aging without talking about dying to a certain extent. Okay, this is what we die from. You probably all know these kind of numbers and have seen them. I just put them up just to remind you. Heart disease is the biggest killer of, this is of the general population in the United States. 1 out of 3, you look around the room, 1 out of 3 is going to die of heart disease. Roughly 1 out of 3 is going to die of cancer, and then it drops off rather precipitously to the other diseases that you see listed here. Only a small percentage of people actually die of Alzheimer's, but in many ways it's one of the worst ways to die in terms of losing one's connection to his or her world and to his friends and family and loved ones. If you're in that 15 to 30-year-old age group, I just thought this is interesting because we often don't think about that. We certainly think that accidents are very common. But suicide and homicide, this is the United States, are number 2 and number 3. And so, again, that points out a little bit about people in this age group, the reproductive years, are not dying of disease, by and large. They're dying of accidents and trauma and suicide and being killed. Another way of looking at the statistics of life and survival is this term, this years of potential lost life. It's YPLL. It's a measure of deaths of individuals before their time. Mm-hmm. People that died prematurely in one way or another. 65 has been this is not my idea of being really old. That's what the statisticians deal with. So 65 or older, you don't count. You figure you live to be 65, you know, if you die, it's not a lost year. But if you're younger, so if you die at 18, you get a credit of 47 lost years of potential life. And so what is this? Again, the United States, accidents, number 1. Cancer, heart disease, suicide, number 4. So that's a very significant impact on years of lost life. Obviously, birth defects, perinatal diseases, homicide significant. Even AIDS starts to show up because it's killing younger people. Any questions just about the general statistics?
Who decided there was no potential after age 65?
Obviously, somebody younger than 65. It's just a statistical for, it could have been set at 75, it could have been set, you know, at 50. So it was a compromise. I mean, who decided that Medicare should be at 65? Actually, it was decided, those of you who were here on Monday, 65 was picked by Otto von Bismarck in Germany. That was the year in which people could retire in Germany. The average 65-year-old in the late 1800s lived for about 2 years after that. I mean, it was a very high mortality. So when you retired, you didn't have a long time in retirement. When we adopted the Social Security at 65 in this country in the 1930s, life expectancy was about 6. The average life expectancy at 65 was about 6 years at that point. Now, if you look in the IRS tables as to how long you are expected to live if you make it to 65, it's close to 20 years. So, and this is one of the reasons why Social Security is in trouble, Medicare is in trouble, is because we're all living longer than we used to. So is a 65 a rational, you make a good point, is 65 a rational year or age at which to retire? Or should we have the workforce? But if we have a workforce working longer, your earlier point that we're going to have more unemployment. And those are problems that I cannot deal with today. Theories of aging. Why do we get old? I mean, we just do, don't we? So there's a lot of theories of aging. And whenever you see somebody put up a list like this, the longer the list, it means we don't know. And so there's lots of theories. There's something called planned obsolescence, or the genetic clock. There's a telomere theory, neuroendocrine dysregulation. What does that mean? Free radicals. Free radicals are oxygen molecules that can damage cells and organelles within the cells, and that presumably antioxidants would be helpful. There's a Hayflick limit theory, the cells can only divide so many times. Mitochondria decline, they do, somatic DNA damage, all these things are theories. Some of them are just markers of age and not necessarily the cause of age. But let's go back to this first one, this planned obsolescence or the genetic clock. When we look at lifespans of animals, how many here have had a pet cat or a dog? Almost everybody. How many had a pet cat that lived for 50 years? How many had a dog that lived for 30 years? You didn't take good care of your pets, did you? It doesn't matter how well you take care of them, they have a built-in life expectancy and a lifespan. And there's some lifespans we throw out there. Fruit flies have a 21-day turnover. One of the fears that many scientists have, as experiments are being done to prolong the life cycle or the lifespan of various animals, and it's been done with certain kinds of roundworms, and we may say a little more about that. Can you imagine what would happen if we doubled the life expectancy of fruit flies, or quadrupled it, or came out with where these bugs didn't die, and they just kept multiplying? And I mean, it could be an ecological disaster for the world. And so this, at what point do some of these experiments in the science sound like they're, oh, this is very interesting stuff, and maybe we'll live longer, and maybe we won't. So that just gives you some idea. Humans are kind of in the middle there. The Galapagos tortoises live 100, on record, maybe 180 years is the longest anyone ever lived. There are some mollusks that live out in the Pacific Ocean that live for 200 years.
Cliff, there's one thing about a close friend of mine, and she's 3 years older than I am, but in as good a health or was, and she just gave up doing things. She came here with me, and she just sat in the room and read a book most of the time. She went on one hike, and we went to Monkey Bear Falls, and she was capable of going there, but she didn't want to do anything else. And it's been very sad for me to see her just quit exercising. And she has osteoporosis and recently broke her hip, but anything you can say won't cheer her up or make her give her any more energy. And when a person just almost makes a decision to be less energetic and to engage the mind less, there seems to be nothing you can do.
That's your little anecdote here will fit in very, very well with some of the things that precisely go in, whether it's exercise, enthusiasm, engagement in life. Taking part in daily activities are all part of this living process and this aging process, and when one starts to either never have those habits or to abandon those habits for whatever reason. Now, it could be a clinical depression in the case of your friend. It may be that there's things going on that we don't know about, or she may have reached a point in her life for whatever reason that this is her choice and her decision. But we'll talk more about that. Again, getting back to this genetic clock or the biologic clock, we certainly are well aware in humans. We grow, we develop. In the first 18 years of life, we reach maturity. We go through puberty pretty much like clockwork. Obviously, some people go a little bit earlier, some a little bit later, but it's built in. I mean, nobody wills themselves to go through puberty that I know of, or I know that people wish they didn't, and other people wish they had it sooner. Menopause certainly is built in. It's a biological clock that seems to determine that, and we live a certain period of time. So there may very well be genetic factors that absolutely control how long we're going to live. And that certainly seems to be the case, and there have been a number of genes identified in some of the more primitive organisms, and there's a certain gene in roundworms that they've been able to remove, and the roundworms live twice as long as they would otherwise. Mm-hmm. Now, they haven't done that to the flies or the cockroaches or something else yet, so roundworm, that doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. They kept them in the lab, but you don't know what these kinds of experiments may ultimately lead to. All right, so there's a lot of different theories. I have a theory. It's not exactly mine, but it's called the Indy 500 race car theory of aging. You all know what the Indy 500 is. There are cars that get these crazy drivers get into, and they drive 250 miles an hour, and they go until they've gone 500 miles, and then the race is over. And those cars are designed and engineered to do everything right for 500 miles. I mean, everything about those cars, I mean, they don't put tires on there that go 50,000 miles. They put tires on there that are going to absolutely not fail in 500. And they have a carburetor, and they have engines and exhaust systems and transmissions. Everything is set that it's going to last for that 500 miles. Now, if you kept driving those cars for 1,000 miles, for 10,000, just kept them going round and round, 20,000 miles, 30,000 miles, pretty soon there'll be no cars running. Everybody agree with that? I mean, you keep putting gas and oil into them, but those cars are going to break. Something's going to break down in every one of those cars. Tires are going to go flat, transmission's going to fall apart. And it may not be the same thing in every car, but every car will ultimately break down. And why? And were they designed by the engineers to break down at 10,000 miles or 20,000? No, they weren't designed to break down. They were designed to go 500, and they just happened to break down. Now I think that humans are designed to go really well for 50 years. Now, I don't think they're designed that way. I think we've evolved that way, and that our bodies have evolved over millions of years, have been optimized through evolution to ensure proliferation and survival of the species rather than a long lifespan for the individual. And living on this planet over the past 50,000 years has been advantageous to the human species to have a 50-year lifespan. It was advantageous to foxes to have a 6-year lifespan, and for mollusks to live for 200. Those that lived longer had some selective disadvantage, and those that kicked off after 100 years, for whatever reason, I mean, I can't explain it, but this evolutionary pressure has led to that. So that's why I think that we live that long, not that we are designed to die, but that we're optimized to live those 50, 60 years to see that the species is reproduced and that we are around long enough to impart some knowledge about the environment, about life, to the next generation so they can continue to live.
It would seem to me that at a certain point, if you can no longer hunt and gather, which is what those groups did, you're all anchor and no, right? You don't bring anything new to the group. You're just a weight, and so it's time to move on.
So it's time to move on, and I think a lot of the primitive societies did exactly that. Whether it's the Eskimo, I mean, I don't know whether all of these stories are true or not. You know, the Eskimo put on the ice floe to float off, or the tribesmen, the elderly tribesmen who couldn't keep up but was left behind as the tribe moved on to the next hunting area.
There are some verbal and there anecdotes, personal histories of. Older Eskimos who described putting their relatives out. And it was very tearful, and usually it was the relative that would, in the accounts I read, it was the relative that would insist it be done, and the children were reluctant.
Sure. Well, other terms for successful aging, so we kind of went through the theories of aging, whether how much we really understand and how much we can impact on. So these are kind of other terms that you'll run across in your reading of aging. Well, I kind of like healthy aging, optimal aging. How can we define it? Low probability of disease or disability. High cognitive. These are the kind of things that we would, if we were to ask you, you know, what do you think is successful aging? You say, well, I'm unlikely that I'm going to have a severe disease or disability. I'm maintaining cognitive function and physical capacity and active engagement with life. And your friend is kind of dropping off on all of those, isn't she? So she would not be somebody that we would say is successfully aged. The scientific community has actually come up with scales by which we could take your friend and take you and then rate you according to the scale about how successful you have aged. Or haven't aged, or how unsuccessful you've been. So no physical. So this is what if we're going to take somebody that's over 75, and and do a scientific assessment. This would be something that Don would do with. He sets up his criteria to determine, you know, all these laws and things lying on top of each other. No physical disability over age 75 as rated by a physician, not as rated by yourself. You have your chance to rate yourself down the bottom. Good subjective health assessment, good mental health, objective social support. Social support is really an important thing. It just comes up over and over. And self-related satisfaction in 8 domains: marriage or a life partner relationship, work, children, friendships, hobbies, community service, religion, and recreation. All those things are, you sort of rate this on a scale 1 to 10 where you, and they give you examples, and you can fill things out, and you can come up with an index or a number that kind of puts you on the scale of, yes, you are successfully aging, and no, there are areas in your life that you might want to pay more attention to achieve better balance. Yes, sir?
Can you define and give an example of objective social support?
If somebody says, oh yeah, I've got great social support, and then you say, well, you know, what is your social support? Well, if they say, well, you know, I'm a member of the Lions Club, I have a book club that I get together with once a week, I have a church group, and I'm on this committee, and I volunteer at this, you could actually document and have an objective, as opposed to just saying, yeah, I get, you know, I have great social support, and not be able to document it anyway. And now, how you rate that into a scale, I don't know. I mean, I'm not involved in this. This is a research tool to try to get a handle on identifying people who have aged well or who have been successful aging, and then go back and look at other characteristics in their life or habits and trying to say, well, this, you know, all these people over here, we have this group that aged really well, what did they do? And it turns out they all ate licorice, or they all ate chocolate, or something. Well, maybe there's an association there, and then you can start to drill down and figure out what that is. Is it just an association, or is it some causal factors involved? Does that make sense? Yes?
On the last one, the 8 domains, are those in that particular order?
No. No. I don't. Let me go back. I don't know that they're in any particular order. I just took that from the study that was reported. I don't think it's in any particular order. I think if you look, it's not alphabetical either. So I don't. I can't say. Okay. Advice from the graveside or the bedside, if I'm giving it. Avoid giving advice, for wise men don't need it and fools won't heed it. And I think we all know that's the case. So from here on in, now you can take all of this with a grain of salt. But there is some evidence out there that does correlate both with longevity and with successful aging. But we kind of get mixed up a little bit on there, and I apologize for if things aren't entirely clear. Dr. Hall's prescription. And this comes back to Monday when we talked about what determines health, the determinants of health. Healthcare, only 10%. Don't overestimate the value of medical care. Just because it's expensive doesn't mean it's valuable. Just try to remember that. There are, and we'll talk more about that other times, but it can lead to a lot of potential problems. And too high expectations of the value of healthcare, and we have in this country, we have extraordinarily high expectations because the medical profession, pharmaceutical industry, the medical device industry have all, and the mass media have all told us about how great it is to have, you know, this drug or that drug or this treatment or that treatment or this heroic, this miracle treatment or whatever. We get too much care. It can lead to too much care. It leads to wasted resources. And we talked about that. If you're spending all your money on health care and you're not spending it on education, and we know that education is actually more important than determining health, that's very wasted. And, of course, adverse effects and complications, a lot of pain and suffering. I have never had a patient tell me that they wish they had more chemotherapy in their last years of life. But I've had many, many patients come back and tell me, if I had known, doctor, if I had any idea what these last 6 months or 3 months or a year would have been like, I would not have gone down that road. And we make poor political decisions. So people overvalue medical care. So we have people at Tea Party meetings and at town hall meetings saying, don't touch my Medicare, because they think it is so valuable that they don't want to give up this little bit, even though their neighbor down the street may have no health care at all, no, at least no health care insurance. So bad decisions are made based on that. Or we have people saying, on the left in Congress, saying, don't, we're not going to touch Medicare. That's absolutely sacred because it is so valuable. And that leads, that decision comes from putting too much value on healthcare in the first place, thinking that that was the major determinant as to why people live long and live well. Okay, I just want to hammer that away all the time. And it's, I'm sure you're sick of hearing it. All right, there are risk behaviors. Having said that, there are some things related to risk factors and behaviors and medicine that do have an impact on longevity. Well, in Oregon, where I'm from, we look at, is everybody over 65 doing what they're supposed to be doing, what they've been told to do and what they probably know they should do? Okay, well, how many are eating 5 fruits and veggies per day? Well, they're not living, they're obviously not living here at Holden Village. Because if they were, they'd be up in that 95% range. But 65% of them don't. So this is the percent that don't do what they're supposed to do. How many have never had a colonoscopy? 49%. There's pretty good evidence that, that colonoscopy is a beneficial. Whether you need one every 10 years or whether if you just have one and it's negative sometime after 50, then that's good. That may be all that you really need. It's a little bit unclear about how frequently you need them. But most people over 50 or 60 probably ought to have a colonoscopy. Sedentary lifestyle, almost half. Never get the pneumonia vaccine or the flu shot. Relatively high percentage of people have not received some basic immunizations that that would help them. We saw that pneumonia on the list of overall, I think it was 6% of people die from flu pneumonia. 11% smoke. That's considerably lower. And it's kind of interesting is that why would the overall, the number of Oregonians that smoke is just over 20% general of adults. Smokers over the age of 65 is 11%. Anybody know why that might be? People get smarter. They die. Very good. So they did not successfully age. However, and I think we may have been talking last night about this over coffee or dinner. If everybody quit smoking in the United States right now, it would cost the U.S. government $283 billion more than what it's going to cost them if they keep smoking. So it actually will cost the government more because people who live longer, they stop smoking, they live longer, they're going to be on Social Security longer. And it actually costs more money. So the government, if you're truly just looking at the dollars and cents, you're the penny bean counters there in Washington, you probably just say, well, let them keep smoking. And, you know, a lot of people employed. And you help unemployment, you drop off, kill more of the workers, right? All right, habits and activities associated with longevity. I didn't bring the book, but I have it in my room up in one of the chalets. The Nun Study, everybody familiar with the Nun Study? It was a study of nuns in convent. The name of the book, and it's in the bookstore, is called Aging with Grace. It's a great book, and they have records of these nuns going back through their whole lives when they first went into the convent, and aspects of their life, their emotional aspects, their psychological aspects, their physical life. I mean, they had a very similar access to health care, and they had very, very similar religious and belief experiences. So the situation is very well controlled, and then they can look at various activities. And what they found in terms of longevity and in their quality of life were these four characteristics. And your friend doesn't have any of these. Exercise, well, I don't know about education. Those nuns that had more education and continued education throughout their life lived longer and were less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. Those that exercised and were more active, similar picture. enthusiasm rated way back when they were 18 years old and went into the convent and then throughout. So it wasn't just late in life, but there are enthusiastic, positive people with positive emotions that they did a whole lot better. So it was like the four E's came out of the study. It's not a very big book. It's a great book, great study, good science in that book.
But weren't those women all healthy when they went into the convent?
Oh, of course. They were all 18 years old or 20.
Well, yeah, but some of them that were sickly wouldn't be allowed to go into the convent.
True.
They moved them out, so they were a healthy group.
They were healthy to start with. Mm-hmm. The overwhelming people, that remember the curve, 18-year-olds, you go out into the population, 18-year-olds, they are basically a very healthy population. There's only a few, a very distinct minority that are sickly. And many of those, you know, if they have cancer or they have some congenital heart disease or they have some severe infectious disease or some severe inflammatory disease, most of those people aren't going to live to be in their 60s and 70s.
But I think there's a certain criteria to go into the convent that some of them just couldn't make the grade and weren't allowed to.
Well, I'm sure, I don't know enough about, you know, it's outlined pretty well in the book. I don't think that physical issues were the major issues, but they were all kind of basically healthy to start with. All right, other habits. Exercise, we just talked about. Diet, low in the food chain, there's lots of evidence, and it's pretty good evidence. A diet that's lower on the food chain, vegetarian, vegan, Mediterranean-type diets are helpful in terms of longevity. I don't know of any evidence that says that you really necessarily have better social engagement and other kinds of things if you follow a vegan diet or a Mediterranean diet. Moderate alcohol consumption, the evidence is very, very strong that individuals who drink alcohol in a moderate fashion, that's 1 to 2 drinks for men and 1 or less for women, and it makes no difference whether it's wine, beer, or spirits. So the red wine story, to a large extent, is a myth perpetrated by the French wine education and curiosity, that again comes to a large extent comes out of the nun study. Well, again, enthusiasm and positive emotions. An Old Testament proverb, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth the bones. All right, sex. Good evidence that individuals who later in life continue to have an active sex life live longer. I wish I had this cartoon, but I don't. It shows a man and a woman in bed, and the man's reading a newspaper, and it says, sex twice a week prolongs life. And he's reading it, and he turns to his wife who's lying next to him, and he says, "Honey, you're killing me." What? I have to find that cartoon, and so I can put it in here. But. All right, a good marriage. A stressful marriage is equal to smoking a pack of cigarettes per day. So a stressful marriage is not a good situation to find oneself in. A good marriage is. Social connectedness is really important. And whether that's through church groups or secular groups or hobby groups or whatever, that kind of interaction, or you're in a bridge group that you get together with people and you have those activities. And they can be through volunteer activities, networking, various kinds of things, and work. So continuing to work continues that social connectedness. Religious activities may have something in addition to this, especially we talked yesterday about prayer, the relaxation response, the changes in brain waves, the lowering of blood pressure, slowing of the pulse rate during prayer and religious activities. Last night, there's no question, during the service when there's this humming of Kirlason and reading those things, I suspect that everybody that was there, almost without exception, maybe some of the young folks were kind of making eyes at each other or whatever, but most of the people that were there, I bet if we were measuring blood pressure, you'd see a drop in blood pressure, you'd see a drop in heart rate, and you would see some change in their brain waves if we had people hooked up for that. That's a very positive kind of thing. Now, you can achieve, you don't have to go to church to achieve that, but it certainly does that. Having a pet, lots of studies have demonstrated that having a pet is associated with improvements in mortality. Taking naps, a big Greek study, naps, but you've got to keep it under an hour.
between 30 minutes and an hour, you get your maximum benefit. You nap longer than an hour, then you start to have more heart attacks again. If you don't nap at all, you have a higher risk of heart attack. One of those curves that looks like that. So no naps is higher. Naps that are too long, it's higher. Chocolate. Music, art, and poetry. I believe it. The data for that is not very scientific. There's people who are involved in those with those activities. The data on nature, they've done studies in recovery from disease. If you're in a hospital, it has a beautiful garden out there, and you look out in the garden, that people do better, lengths of stay are shorter. Gardening has a huge amount of benefits, but there's a number of reasons in terms of being outdoor, being active, being involved in things that are growing. Caloric restriction is one of those paradoxical things, and it came out of some of the war experience where everybody thought that, especially in Europe during World War II, where there were periods of time where there was essentially famine over large parts of the population, they had a higher increase of tuberculosis during that period of time. And so more people died during that caloric restriction. But then as those people have been followed over a longer period of time, the survivors have lived longer and lived better. In terms of their longevity and their quality of life. And we can, in the laboratory, if you just take a group of rats and feed them their regular diet, give them everything they want to eat, and then take another group of rats, genetically identical, and cut their caloric intake by 30% or so that they're thinner rats, they live 15 to 20% longer than those rats that have unlimited access to food.
So can we just use all of our calories by eating chocolate?
Except for those calories you get with alcohol. So remember Jean Calmont. She had olive oil and chocolate and port wine.
And there's no calories in cigarettes, right?
Yeah, that's right. And she had that. So and getting good sleep, we have a sleep deprived nation. All right. Well, what are some of the chemicals or foods that might be associated with it? We mentioned alcohol, chocolate. You seem to be very interested in green tea. There have been a number of studies that suggest that individuals who drink green tea, olive oil has been part of the Mediterranean diet and it's a good form of calories. There's something called resveratrol, which is a substance that's in red wine. And animal studies, they've been able to prolong the lives of laboratory animals by as much as 50% by feeding them a certain quantity of that compound. You would have to drink, in order to get the same amount, you would have to drink like six cases of wine per night. which is impossible, but they can isolate this stuff and concentrate it, and it is available. It's on there's a couple of websites on the internet where you can get it in a tablet format. Anybody take it in here?
Would it also be in grape juice?
I'm sorry?
Would it also be in grape juice?
Yes, it's in grape juice, but it's also in such a tiny... in such a tiny dose. So, you know, is a tiny dose of any value? It certainly isn't going to hurt you, I don't think, but... you know, whether it's going to have very much of an effect. Sirtuins, how many here have heard of sirtuins? Nobody has. They are chemicals made in the body. They're proteins that regulate chromosomes. And there's at least six of them in humans that have recently been discovered, and they're in every animal as well. And by adjusting the concentration of these things or deleting the genes in laboratory animals, you can make those animals live almost twice as long as they would live otherwise. And so maybe we're getting into the biological clock mechanisms, regulation of genes, because, you know, we humans have fewer genes than mice. I don't know if that's upsetting to us, so it isn't the number of genes. When they did the Human Genome Project, we thought, you know, mice had like 22,000 to 24,000 genes, and we said, oh, well, humans are going to have like 100,000 genes at least. You know, we're smarter than everything. The mice are bigger, and it turns out that we had fewer, and
And that kind of upset everybody, but it's the regulation of the genes that really is important. There's a lot of information on the chromosomes that is involved in regulation, and these substances are key in the regulation. Carnitine, I don't know much about. Rapamycin is a substance from the soil on Christmas Island. Is Christmas Island the one with those big rock faces?
That's Easter Island.
It's Easter Island, not Christmas Island. I get those religious holidays all mixed up. That's a joke. So it's fun. It's not, obviously not funny here.
We have to live with that.
It's on Easter Island. Or did you say Christmas Island? Easter Island. And it's in the soil, wherever it is, it's in the soil, it's a substance in the soil, it's made by some fungi that live specifically on that particular island, and when it's injected into animals, laboratory animals, it can extend their life. I put walnuts down there because there's some suggestive evidence that walnuts may have some substance that has not yet been identified that may improve longevity. Okay, visit Holden Village, participate in educational programs, healthy food, religious services, and outdoor activities. That's a good way to age well. Study geology. I think you've heard, those of you that have been to the best lecture that we've heard all week, and we've heard it over and over, is that if you study geology, you're going to have community and friendship, and you're going to have arm waving, which is exercise, you're going to be outside, you're going to be problem solving, you'll be drinking beer or root beer, and you're going to do this amongst friends. And so geology has all the elements that we've talked about, and even there were, I think there were chocolate chips in the cookies too, right? Or M&M's, so that you even got the chocolate in there, so good job.
I don't look bad for 94, do I?
keep engaged. That's probably, and it's the big letters there, because that probably is...
So don't get married, is that what you're saying?
I didn't say get engaged, or don't get married. That's probably not bad advice from Don. There's another side to aging, and in large part it involves a series of losses. So we've talked about the positive things and all the things we can do, but we lose throughout our whole lives, from the time we go off to kindergarten and we leave our mother's apron strings behind, and go off to college and leave the town that we grew up in behind, and we leave friends behind, and friends die. As we get older, our status may change as we are no longer employed, and some people find that their whole being is involved in that. As we get older still, we lose independence and mobility, we lose our health. And so these are all losses that occur in the aging process. And we can't deny that, and there's no way of saying, well, not me. I'm never going to be sick, and I'm never going to lose mobility, and I'm never going to lose my status in the world. Everybody's going to respect me even when I'm 102 years old. Yeah, right. So this is, Jeanette Batts wrote an article, it was in, I think, Atlantic Monthly, and her conclusions were that the person most able to accept the infirmity, aging, and death is usually the person who has been able to express feelings, I think it should have an S there, and to grieve losses throughout their life. And if you can get in touch with that and handle that, you may very well be able to deal with those other losses that come along in a much more healthy fashion. Mm-hmm. We talked about prolonging things. Richard Asher says, I'd like to see our patients and our public cease their vain strivings after longevity, and I realize that it's better to live for 70 years without fussing than to achieve the age of 80 with elaborate, painstaking care. And I think there's something in that. And you know, all those things, if you like chocolate, eat chocolate. Don't eat chocolate because you think it's going to make you live longer. And enjoy those things. If you like being outside and gardening, and you like the sense of community and being involved, I don't think we ought to be doing things just for the purpose of living a little bit longer. And Cliff Hall here put this together this afternoon. This is my philosophical statement here, that aging well is living well. It is giving to others. It is accepting our limitations with humor and dignity. It is remaining engaged with life. It is living with enthusiasm, loving deeply, and laughing often. And I think if I don't have anything about chocolate or wine or anything, or being married or anything else in there, it's just enjoy what we have, adapt to the changes that we're going to go through, and every one of us is going to go through, and we have to adapt to them, and we have to, we'll grieve those losses, but at the same time, we can laugh at ourselves and laugh at our friends and laugh with our friends. So thank you very much.